are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Man watching the cup on a restaurant patio is shot dead on a busy Sunday afternoon in Toronto. Another dies in a sidewalk ambush just outside a bustling college campus. Two men in a Vancouver hotel lobby are gunned down in an attack that sends an American soccer star scrambling for cover. In Mexico, a Canadian is killed at a Nuevo Vallarta coffee shop, his death barely registering amidst the terrifying death tolls of President Calderon's war on drugs and the cartel's response, while a Montreal cop is beaten within an inch of his life in a Playa del Carmen nightclub. An infamous heckler from an NBA Toronto Raptors game turns up dead in a bullet-riddled car in a midtown laneway. Throughout the 2010s, these and other disparate acts of violence entered the public awareness like isolated tragedies, but there was nothing isolated about them. In this masterly investigation, veteran journalists Peter Edwards and Louise Najera introduce listeners to the common cause of a near decade of chaos. Meet the Wolf Pack, millennial-aged gangsters from across the spectrum of Canada's underworld, vying to fast-track their way into the criminal void left by the death of Montreal godfather Vito Rizzuto. The Wolfpack sought advantage in a steady supply of cocaine from El Chapo Guzman's Sinaloa cartel, among the deadliest and most far-reaching of criminal organizations. The juniors had just stepped into the big leagues. This is the rolling landscape of the Wolfpack, a brilliant examination of a time of criminal disruption and rapid adaptation, when one gang's unchecked ambition unwittingly gave away the most hotly contested corner of the Canadian underworld without a fight. Brazen criminal disruptors or entitled upstarts looking to get rich without paying their dues, whatever you think of them, you will never forget the Wolf Pack. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Wolf Pack, Millennial Mobsters Who Brought Chaos and the Cartels to the Canadian Underworld, with my special guest, investigative journalist and author, Peter Edwards. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Peter Edwards.
Oh, thanks for having me, Dan.
Thank you. It's been a little while since we last spoke. Congratulations on this book, as I had mentioned. Let's talk about, just initially, because we mentioned Luis Horacio Najera. Tell us just about the planning and the gestation of this book.
Louise worked in Juarez, which is right across the border from El Paso, Texas, and he covered organized crime, and so he was kind of knee-deep in this stuff, and he knew 12 journalists who either were murdered or committed suicide because of attacks on them, and who covered this sort of thing. So he was exposed to just an extremely rough environment, sort of like a war zone. And then his life and his family's lives were in danger. He had gotten really credible threats, and so he fled up to Canada. Another journalist, Jim Rankin from The Star, a nice guy who's well-connected, he introduced us, and so Louise and I were kind of looking for a project, and then someone told me about in Quebec how there was a group of millennials who were functioning on a high level, but they were like an association. They weren't the normal mafia or the normal bikers, and so we found that fascinating. And when we looked at them, we found that they were tightly tied to the Sinaloa cartel down in Mexico, the guys Luis used to cover. And so But we decided just to take a look at why these guys were important and how the cartel was using them. It was like a really interesting project to work on, and then it was a chance for me to learn about Mexico and the internet through Luis, so it was a great opportunity for me.
Were you surprised, given the expertise that you have regarding organized crime in Canada and outlaw biker gangs in Canada, were you surprised that some of the information you were getting?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to accept that the internet's changing things, but I'm a bit of a Luddite. Like, I'm not the best person on a cell phone or the best person. I'm not the guy you want to fix your computer. And then once I told this junior reporter, don't worry about cell phones, you know, we don't need them. So my technical advice isn't that great, but Luis is kind of the other way, and he really sees the impact of different media sources on people, and so he was pushing me to read up on it, and it all started, the lights went on, like the guys, the new wave, the millennials, it all starts on the internet, and geography doesn't really matter, and so, but a lot of stuff that in high school I kind of laughed at, you know, Marshall McLuhan and the Global Village, I had to go back and read that and think about that because it actually made sense before. Yeah, I thought it was kind of gibberish back then, but now, you know, someone who's deadly serious and who's had friends murdered and who isn't joking around about it, he's saying, you know, this stuff makes sense. And it actually did make sense. This is a crime group that functions on the internet because of the internet, and this is the future. Like, the future of organized crime is internet-based.
Yeah, well, this will definitely demonstrate that, illustrate that vividly. Let's get right to it, to the chapter you call Zelda and Dean Michael Wichar. And his, you introduce this guy, and he is a hitman. So this is, and you also talk about the Wolf Pack. So please introduce Dean Michael Wichar and Johnny Raposo, and what happened in January 2012, and the Wolf Pack.
So Wichar, he's a hitman for the Wolf Pack, and he's very proud of it. You can get someone killed for a few thousand bucks. Like, it's not brain surgery to shoot somebody. You know, you just find the right guy, point the gun, and pull the trigger. Like, kind of any moron can do it. But these guys wanted something that made a splash on the internet, and they wanted something that was like out of a video game or a spy movie. And so Wichar was their man. He wore makeup. He would had putty that he put on his face to change his features. He dressed up like a construction worker. He had a wig. He flew in from Vancouver, and he took a real roundabout route, and he made a couple trips to Toronto to scout out the area. He had a wide assortment of guns, and he didn't really need them all. He just liked the flash of it. And his background, he wasn't this isn't some poor kid from the ghetto or some guy brought up from some tough housing project. This is a kind of a bored kid from the suburbs who, you know, too much free time and too much video game time, maybe. And he, and someone with an absolute lack of empathy, he was brought in to kill someone who has taken part in a drug deal with the Wolf Pack. And they, a lot of times with drugs, what they'll do is have four people buy in on a deal, and that way if the drugs are intercepted, you don't lose everything. Like, if you do that four times, you're going to at least have some drugs come through, and it's right, kind of the safer way of doing it. And so as the drugs got closer to Toronto, one of the group decided that if he got rid of Raposo, his money would go way up, and for some reason Raposo really annoyed him. And so he got Wichar to kill Raposo, and they did it when a Euro Cup soccer game was on and Raposo was sitting right under the big screen. Like, they did it as theatrically as possible in a patio in a really nice area so that he had hundreds of spectators. And it could have been done discreetly, or it could have been done without witnesses, but they actually wanted the splash of witnesses. They wanted to make a sensation on the internet, and so he walked right up and shot him. It was interesting because the guy sitting beside him was someone who was was mob connected and had a bit of a debt, and so there was the feeling that this guy might have set up Raposo, and so the guy would come and you'd shoot the guy to the right of the guy in the green shirt, sort of thing. Like you wouldn't know your target, but you'd know, you know, what the guy sitting beside him looked like, and so you just shoot the guy beside him, which is kind of a chilling thought. If you stole the wrong chair at that soccer game, you would have been shot, maybe. But wow. And it was at an ice cream shop. Like, it was a really nice sidewalk cafe where the big feature was Italian ice cream. And they just wanted to make a splash. They wanted people to notice it. And Wivchar was just thrilled. I mean, he was like, it was like his prom queen. I mean, he couldn't have been happier. And announcing it on the internet. And I know someone who knows Wivchar from behind bars, and he said that Wivchar was bragging about how big of a hole he put in the guy. But this is like an absolute total lack of empathy. And he didn't know the person he killed. And he, you know, this is someone with a family in blocks from where his mother lived, and it was no problem for him to end the guy's life there.
Well, you include even more to this real-life horror that it was Father's Day, it was an Italian food festival for this street, a Little Italy food festival, and his hero, we haven't time to go into it, but his hero, his mentor, Eddie Mello, his little son who had, Mello was murdered, his son was with him, the widow, the mother of the son, was there as well. And so there was a whole family, and again, like you say, this Father's Day, they made every attempt to make this about family and not just about their grievances.
Yeah, and I got to know or talk to Eddie Mello's kid, and a really, really nice guy, and not criminal at all. And his father was murdered, and so this kid, Raposo, took him on. He became like the nice uncle. He'd drive him around. He said that he always got to ride in the front seat, that he was treated with a ton of respect when he was a wee little kid, treated really nicely, and that Raposo tried to fill the void that that Eddie Jr. felt when he lost his father. And so Raposo wasn't some terrible knuckle-dragging monster. He was, he's on the wrong side of the law, but he tried to be nice to people that mattered to him, and in a lot of ways, he was a good person.
Mm-hmm. So what is the description that they get on who shot Raposo? And then what does the hitman Wichar do? What happens?
So the description was that it was the kind of a tall, gangly construction worker with a limp. And so Wivchar, he looks like a backup player on a basketball team. Like, he's this tall, skinny, intense-looking guy. Mm-hmm. And he wore a blonde wig and a construction vest and face makeup. And so he killed him, and then he very quickly bragged about it on the internet. He very quickly went into pretty good privacy and told everybody that he'd done it. And the rest of the Wolfpack were just thrilled. The person who was paying his bills, and he got $100,000 for killing him, which is a huge amount mm-hmm. for a hitman. It's way more than you need, but these guys aren't really dealing in reality. The guy who paid for it, he joked about how they should send him to sniper school and, you know, make him an even better killer. And the hitman couldn't have been happier. And there were all these sort of internet cheering. I mean, it was sort of this bizarre thing, because you've got this young kid grieving for the second time a mob murder, hitting his family, a really nice kid. So while this kid's at one of the lowest points in his life, these other idiots are cheering away as if they, you know, just scored a big goal in the World Cup. Like, it was a really surreal type of thing. And it was all over money. I mean, there was no, Raposo wasn't some evil monster they had to slay. He was just getting a chunk of a deal that they wanted to take his share.
Explain this idea about the secret stash that Raposo had set aside, apparently, that was supposed to be untraceable. How does this turn into much more than that in itself?
That was interesting, because the a lot of times when someone's killed, then you try to get their money or get their drugs quickly. Like there's usually something lying around. And there's a huge amount of ripping off. And that's the big difference with these cartel guys. You don't rip them off. Like you absolutely don't, because they literally have accountants in the greater Toronto area, and they know what's going in and what's going out, and they're smart guys, and it's not a bunch of guys from a bar or a bunch of kind of rough guys. These are very smart people who, it's what they do for a living. And so Raposo had taken some of the drug stash, and then his friends came in and grabbed that. What that meant was that the cartel had been ripped off, and so you've got these angry cartel guys running around, and it's not so much losing the drugs that bothers them, it's the precedent. Like, they don't want to be trifled with, and they want they want you to be afraid of going against them, and so they want to do things right over the top, and so if you rip them off at all, you're in trouble. And so it was almost revenge from the grave for Raposo. You know, his friends stole the money that he stole, and now the Wolfpack's being blamed for it. And so that set off a lot of paranoia, because you have these angry cartel people running around, and the people who've just done this cowardly murder on Raposo are now they're in the crosshairs themselves.
Mm-hmm. And you're dealing with El Chapo Guzman, so. And the Sinaloa cartel. So what happens with this fear with these millennials, and what happens with the revenge in mind of the cartel?
So one of the people involved with the killers, Caputo, he eventually went to prison as part of the murder of Raposo, but he was kind of unreachable where he was in custody. What the cartel did to make a point, it hasn't been proven, but it makes pretty good sense. His mm-hmm. brother, who was honest, who ran a restaurant, who wasn't a criminal, 64 years old and no criminal record, and I'd never heard of him doing bad stuff, but he was related to, you know, a very serious criminal. He was just shot to death outside of his restaurant, and it looked like he was in fear because he was trying to sell his restaurant cheaply. Like, he's trying to just dump the restaurant and get out of town, and he didn't do it quick enough. And so I think he caught a whiff that there would be revenge. I mean, you don't get the last laugh on these cartel guys. In Mexico, there was a monument put up to journalists who were murdered. And so, I mean, it's a nice tribute to them. And then one morning, mm-hmm. there's someone's head, like they beheaded someone and stuck the head at the bottom of the monument just to let them know that, you know, we're still here. There was a police raid, and they found out who one of the Marines was and went after his family. Like they need to get the last word, and they will. And so even in Canada, if they feel they've been ripped off, watch out.
Yeah. Now you take us to a couple people. The Wolf Pack, one of the leaders of the Wolf Pack is this Robbie Alcalillo. And he lives with a person named Amaro in an apartment in Montreal. So what happens, you talk about a raid in August 2012, but you also talk about these guys on the run.
Yeah, that was really fascinating because Amaro, he's a full-patch Hells Angel, so he's totally into the program, but he's from the West Coast. And so he started mm-hmm. with one charter, shifted to another charter, and then went right across the country. And he narrowly escaped being murdered in Kelowna. There was one of his associates was killed, and he's lucky he wasn't as well. He went right across the country. He was in a condo with Al Khalil that I think was $8,000 a month. Like, it was in a really nice complex that some of the Montreal Canadiens live in, really high end, overlooking the river. And those two shared the place. Al Khalil, he turned 25 while we were working on the book. This is a very young guy. He had, I think, four brothers, and Palestinian refugees, so brought up in a, basically brought up in a war zone and looking at things the way a person in a war would look at things. Very tough, and he doesn't have to be emotional about things, like he'll just do it. He ran, it's pretty bizarre, but he ran this women's clothing store where the belts could cost $10,000, like these.
Wow.
I think you pronounce it Hermes belts, $10,000, which I don't know if I've spent $10,000 on clothing in my entire life, but they were buying these belts. And the guy, and he ran this boutique place, and he's 25 years old, and he also was the guy in charge of the hitmen. And so his idea of money was just not from my universe. Like, he's paying the hitman probably 20 times more than he needs to because he likes the sensation it makes on the internet. And that was kind of advertising, you know, take the wolf pack seriously, they'll shoot you anywhere. And the running this high-end women's clothing store, setting up hits. And then when he got in trouble, he changed his name. And so his internet name became Run and Hide, which was kind of a joke. And then he just took off. They eventually caught him, I think it was in West Germany. But he it also showed how geography doesn't really matter for these guys. Like with the Hells Angels,
right.
You look and look at a patch on their chest, and it tells you exactly where they're from. And so,
right.
South Simcoe Street, Oshawa, that sort of thing. These guys, Wolfpack, they can show up anywhere. And when that one bunch of them took off, someone showed up in Greece. Someone showed up chopped up in Colombia. Someone showed up in West Germany. Like, you could, they're extremely mobile, multi-ethnic. It's kind of odd because they're not racist, where a lot of organized criminals are racist. These guys aren't. They're sort of woke. Someone called them the woke pack because they actually are. They've got some good qualities. It's just that they sell drugs and murder people indiscriminately. Like, they're not racist, and they've got a member who's in a wheelchair. Like, they do some things that other organized crime groups wouldn't do, but then they're absolutely ruthless and without empathy when it comes to doing business.
Now, you introduced this Sukhvir Dak, and his brother had been killed, Gurmit. But what is the connection with Amaro? And you've introduced a couple of notorious gangsters, Riach and Bacon, from Vancouver.
Yeah, it's kind of dizzying when you get into the Vancouver stuff, because it's almost like reading the Bible, and so-and-so begat so-and-so begat so-and-so. Like, you have all these feuds begat another feud, begat another feud, and so former friends are turning on friends. And the biggest thing I took out of all of that was that, at first, it's extremely hard to get out. Like, when the one big brother was killed, he had desperately wanted his little brother to get out of this stuff, and he had actually talked to a cop about trying to help my little brother get out of it. But you can't really get out because nobody's going to believe you. Like, if your brother's murdered, they're going to assume you want revenge. And if you're already a murderer, what's one more? You know, like, it becomes a different way of looking at things. And a lot of them who used to be friends end up as enemies. I was talking to one guy who talked about the feeling of having dinner with somebody and you're setting up his hit. And so you've got a killer waiting in the parking lot, and you're eating sushi with him in a restaurant, and then you're texting the killer with pretty good privacy. You know, he's got the blue shirt on, he's coming out in 5 minutes, but meanwhile you're joking with the guy or splitting the tip with him on the meal. It becomes this odd world, and it's all about alliances and associations, but none of them, they're all just about a deal. Like, they're not ethnic, they're not geographic, they're not philosophical, it's just greed. And so if you and I decide to become associates, you get all of my enemies, I get all of your enemies, and I might not know who all your enemies are, so I don't know who's after me now. So there's this joke, help, I'm being chased by paranoids. Like, you have a paranoid group of people who become more paranoid because they don't know anyone who smiles at them. And if someone says, love you, bro, you know, 3 times in 10 minutes, you know, dive on the floor, you're in trouble. Like, you're probably going to get shot.
Yeah, certainly. Now, you talk about the West Coast and Vancouver, but you talk about a little place that's a tourist place, and the importance of a place on the West Coast called inland, British Columbia, called Kelowna. Tell us a little bit more about this connection.
Kelowna is fascinating because it's a beautiful, beautiful place. Like it's kind of everything you want. If you could win a house anywhere, you know, Kelowna is a pretty good spot to be. And I mean, they're really, really nice resort there. And some of the Wolfpack were staying there. Like these guys really are into the luxury stuff. And one of the Wolfpack guys was, whenever he got stressed out, he was going for a massage. Like he'd be setting up someone's murder and then needing a de-stressing massage. And so these Wolfpack guys are all around this really, really nice resort in Kelowna, and their enemies from a group called United Nations, which is kind of ironic, but they track them down and open fire on them. And they killed one. They almost killed the Amaro guy we were talking about. And something that is just different from other groups, and I'm not saying that the traditional groups are, you know, great examples of humanity all the time, but they killed a woman and paralyzed another woman. Like they just opened fire on the Porsche that these guys were staying in or driving in. And so there wasn't any need to isolate the victim. When you talk to the real old school guys, they one guy told me once that it's an odd feeling to walk right up to the person you're going to shoot and, you know, almost smell his breath and then shoot him. These guys didn't do that. They just sprayed the car. And that's a more cowardly way of doing it, and you'll still kill him, but you'll also, you know, they put one woman into a wheelchair. They killed another woman, you know, and the woman had nothing criminal. They just had kind of bad taste in friends.
Mm-hmm. So what happens next with the Wolfpack?
It's odd because the model will carry on. Like with Louise, a very bright guy who's been watching this stuff for quite a while, his thing is that they're the present and the future, and that even if you lock these guys up, this is just the way to go now. Like with the internet, it's the safest way to do crime because I can buy drugs off you and you don't really know who I am and I don't really know who you are. I just have people vouch for me or I put up money or whatever. And it's tough for police to crack because you have encrypted messaging. We only got all this information because one of the Wolfpack guys who, you know, isn't the brightest guy on the block, he couldn't remember his passwords, and so he left them on a sticky note. And when police went into his condo, they found them there, and they were able to tap in. If it wasn't for that, I wouldn't have a book, and five guys wouldn't be in prison for murder.
Mm-hmm. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor. Did you know that there are over 10 million job openings, but only 7.6 million unemployed job seekers? And this issue is being worsened due to a mismatch of employers and qualified talent. So employers are having to go above and beyond to entice people to work for them, such as offering pet insurance or providing discount programs, offering legal services, or even providing identity theft protection. If you can relate to any of these challenges of growing your team, then you need to try ZipRecruiter. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter uses powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. Then it proactively presents those candidates to you. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated hiring site in the U.S. based on G2 ratings. ZipRecruiter's technology is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, Peter, we were talking about, and you were just about to introduce, Nick Nero, and another aspect of this fascinating tale. So tell us about Nick Nero, and we introduced some other people named Dronjak and Flacco. So and all subordinates of Carnalito. So introduce us to this group of people.
Nero was a bodybuilder and fairly accomplished at that. He also took a run at being a professional wrestler, and he was a steroid trafficker, but he was well under 6 feet, but he got his weight up to 285 without much body fat. Like, he was really jacked up, and then he got bored with pro wrestling as well. He was part of a big armored car heist in the Niagara region, and the money was never recovered. There's a strong feeling that Nero kept a fair bit of the money, and that allowed him to buy in on drug shipments. Like, if you're not part of a big group, but you have a big wad of money, then people will befriend you, and they'll get you to invest in what they're trying to bring in. So Nero was able to almost buy his way into the game. He wasn't the most secure, modest guy in the world, and he had two Ferraris. One was bright red. He traded up in Ferrari, which you kind of wonder, why do you need a faster Ferrari than your $400,000 one? And then he basically a very, very kind of an angry guy who at one point he wanted three people killed at the same time, and it wouldn't take too much for Nero to turn on you. He tried to get Al Khalil to have those guys killed, and Al Khalil was trying to figure out which belts to order for his women's clothing store. So you have these bizarre situations where one guy's talking about $10,000 belts and the other guy's begging him to kill three people, and they have a conversation back and forth. And then Nero is into fashion, and so at some point he kind of loses interest in the three murders and starts talking about women's belts. Some of the stuff gets bizarre. When Nero gets stressed out, he goes to Yorkville in Toronto, and he gets massages. When he's all stressed out, he'd hire people to put oils on him and rub him, and expensive people. And someone who went to school with him said he was dumb as a bag of hair, and that's almost unfair to the bag of hair. Like, he wasn't a bright guy, but he was extremely ambitious. He was like, I don't know, when I was a kid, I used to watch this thing, Pinky and the Brain, and had this guy who's always trying to take over the world. He was kind of like that. Huge ambitions, and he, Hell's Angels wouldn't go near him. Like, he couldn't get into the established groups, but on the other hand, he had a lot of money, and you wanted to be in with him. He ran a gym, he ran a restaurant. He would go to, there's one restaurant in Niagara Falls where some of the old mob guys would go, and Nero would come rolling in his red Ferrari, and people would, it was almost, he might as well show up with two white tigers. Like, it's just too much attention. Like, these guys want things nice and quiet, and Nero might as well be banging on a drum. So Nero was a very, very violent guy who wasn't really, really part of anything until the Wolfpack came along, and then he really got into it. Like, he loved the finally being part of a group. If you had a poster child for male insecurity, you couldn't do much better than Nick Nero.
Wow. So talk about his associates, and then, again, other than this narcissistic preoccupation with things not so serious, what are they planning?
So Nero is getting in on a big drug shipment with the Wolfpack, and so there are four of them. One of them is Raposo. For some reason, Nero really develops just this huge dislike for Raposo. It might be because Raposo probably had this natural confidence and arrogance that Nero just didn't have. Like, I think Raposo would kind of laugh at Nero, snicker at Nero. Raposo had been friends with Eddie Mello, and Eddie Mello was a world-class boxer, and so Raposo knew what tough was. Nero was banging on his chest, pretending to be a pro wrestler and posing in little bathing suits, with his body oiled up. Like, he wasn't a real tough guy. He was kind of a cartoon version. And I think that Nero just fixated on Raposo. He also wanted the share of the money, like four of them in on the deal. If you get rid of one, all of a sudden you go up a fair bit. And so there was that. I think there was a lot of insecurity. I mean, at one point, Nero was staying in a halfway house in St. Catharines, and he he claimed to be broke, but he was driving a $400,000 red sports car. And so, you know, that would suggest he did have some money somewhere. And then people around him told him he can't keep driving that Ferrari to the halfway house. And so he started driving a Denali, which isn't bad at all, but he was whining away about, you know, a great man like him shouldn't have to drive a Denali. So he had very, very expensive tastes and huge amount of ambition, horrible people skills. I mean, he sent this one poor guy down to Mexico to work on the drug deals, and the guy was a car salesman who was in the middle of a divorce and desperately needed the money, and he had no skills whatsoever in testing drugs or just, I mean, it's a pretty complicated business. Mm-hmm. He had no skills in it at all, and Nero just dumped the guy down there and then turned on the guy because the guy was complaining and whining, which I think anyone would do in that situation. I mean, he was in an extremely dangerous spot with a different language, not knowing what he was doing. I mean, I think, and not being well paid and being verbally abused by Nero, I think anyone would turn on him. At one point, someone suggested to Nero that he treat his staff better, that he was nicer to people, he'd have more loyalty, and Nero just couldn't take that. But he was kind of, he wasn't the most, you know, tolerant boss, kind of a rough guy to be around.
Right. You introduced this criminal mentor, Scarsella, and then the budding association with Martino Caputo, which you already introduced, but also the role of Playa del Carmen, Cancun, in Mexico.
Yeah, those are really interesting. The Scarsella one was fascinating, and I mean, he'll never open up to me, and he's out of prison, and so he had been very close to Paul Volpe, the murdered Toronto mobster. It's kind of interesting right. that he wanted to do his parole in Nick Nero's backyard, and that would kind of interesting that all of a sudden you're not wanting to live in York region, but you're wanting to live down in the Niagara region where things are kind of the Wild West and where you'd have a chance to really do something and less competition. Smart guy who doesn't say much, who he's a survivor. I mean, his boss got murdered and he didn't, which a lot of people think, you know, suggests he wasn't the most loyal guy in the world. But he was very, very smart, a big, big survivor, but from the old school, but seeing that the times are changing. So, and really, really deep into the old mob stuff. Playa del Carmen, that's a place where there's a lot of face-to-face meeting. So there's a lot of business done on the internet, but at some point, people want to actually see the other person or see someone connected to the other person. And so that's a nice resort spot. And so people in the drug trade can go there and they can just blend in with all the other partiers and people, you know, having a good time. A police officer down there, so a Montreal police officer who was very junior and inexperienced and idealistic, he went down there and saw some Hells Angels hanging around with some suspicious people, hanging around with some cops. And so he started taking cell phone pictures of it, and they caught him and beat him within an inch of his life. And there were Wolfpack guys involved in that. And so they had absolutely no problem with dragging a cop off to the side and beating him until he required reconstructive surgery.
Wow.
Down there, there are things that happened that would be a scandal up here that don't really make the news down there. That was one thing that really hit me working on the book was some guys would go down there thinking they could push around these cartel guys and they just get swallowed up. Some guys would go down there trying to hide out and they just vanish. And it's a way rougher league than we have here. Luis, he had 12 people that he bumped up against professionally who either were murdered or driven to suicide by reporting on the cartel stuff. So it's just a way, way different league. Up here, there are rules and there are things you just don't do. Down there, it's kind of, it's gone the other direction, and you almost want to show how you'll do anything. And so there's that. I mean, one thing that threw me for a loop was when we're looking at crime statistics, there's one for beheading. Like they actually keep a crime stat for drug trafficker beheadings. I mean, you know, it's like that's just not what we have up here.
No, absolutely not. You talk about this Carnalito, the cartel connection, and this PGP text messaging encrypted. You feature so much of these conversations. Fascinating.
Yeah, the Carnalito guy I thought was really fascinating because he's from a place called Reynosa, and that's a place that's just absolutely lost. Like you, the role of the police there is, you know, it's gone. Like they, like this is a place where the cartels have won, and it's just which cartel has the upper hand.
Yeah.
Very, very rough place, and Carnalito was there. Carnalito is a nickname. It's sort of like little brother. And the one that the Wolfpack was dealing with, and there was a feeling that he was about three tiers down from El Chapo Guzman, which is, you know, very high up, but not at the top of the heap, but very, very high up. And he just dealt with him through the internet. So they had this big, long relationship with him, and he very, very businesslike, and he try to be polite and nice, but he was clearly he was the one in charge, but they never actually knew his name. And so these Wolfpack guys are, you know, you're having these multi-million dollar deals and people's lives at stake, and they don't even know the name of the guy they're dealing with. And he could change his identity, you know, very quickly. Like on the internet, I can go from being Joe Blow to you know, anything, you know, whenever I want, just by changing my name. So They never knew really who Carnalito was, and he never had the need to show them. He could just arrange the drugs. And he could kind of pick and choose and evaluate people. And so he had a lot of control up here. And they'd send up drugs where maybe 60% of what they sent up would be accounted for, but the other 40% would be in their hands and cartel hands, and that would allow them to make sure that nobody had full control. Like you don't want one group to have too much power. You want to, you kind of want them all to be fighting. If I'm an arms runner, I want to sell guns to both sides in my perfect arms runner world. Or, you know, they don't want one group having control of the market. It's better to have everybody scrambling a bit. And so the cartel would hold back, and they could reward certain people and punish certain people. A Carnalito would be the guy for that. And the odd thing was that they all bragged about their association with him, but none of them saw him. It was sort of like the Wizard of Oz, you know, just being down there, you know, on the internet, and they could send him a message, and they were all thrilled, you know, when he'd respond, but they didn't. The guy could walk right by them, and they wouldn't know.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. And we're talking about Nero, and he's on the run, but he doesn't realize that he's being surveilled. He has, instead of the Ferrari that you talk about, he's got this, what he thinks is pretty humble and almost not, is not due his respect, but that van or that vehicle has a secret recorder in there. So tell us what happens.
Yeah, Nero thought that it was just like the cruelest thing ever, you know, that he had to drive a Denali, this big SUV type of vehicle, when he wanted to drive his Lamborghini or one of his Ferraris. And to make it worse, his Denali had a police listening device in it. So it's kind of odd, because a lot of the stuff is kind of spy versus spy and people being recorded all the time. There's one guy who I got to talk to who was on the other side from the Wolfpack, and he talked about it's almost like a way of life. You stick a GPS under somebody's car and you monitor where they go, like everybody's GPSing everybody. And so, but Nero, who's not the brightest bulb out there, he is squealing away about how he has to drive a Denali and, you know, how can this happen to a great man like me? And he can't drive his Ferraris anymore, or not for a little while. And he's acting as if it's the cruelest thing ever, you know, that poor little murderer like him has to drive a Denali. It's funny.
Right.
There was something, it's sort of weird because reading the text, you really develop a dislike for the guy.
Mm-hmm. Now, he's under surveillance, but he has a problem with computers. He's not tech-savvy like young guys usually are. And so what does he do as a result to remember his email address and the password?
Yeah, and this was one where, if it wasn't for Nero, I probably wouldn't have a book on this thing. What Nero
mm-hmm.
couldn't do was remember his password, and it was an encrypted one. And so he puts it on a little sticky note, and he puts that in the kitchen. So, here's how you get on. And the police go sneaking in, they see it. And then they go sneaking back in 3 months later, and it's still there. So in 3 months, he's still, maybe there are 8 characters to memorize or something. But, by getting in there, you see details of planning murders. You see people celebrating murders. You see drug deals. You see all sorts of stuff. I mean, there are 5 people went to prison for first-degree murder because Nick Nero couldn't remember his password. And apparently in prison right now, people aren't all that amused by that. Like some of them don't take that too well.
Mm-hmm. So now what happens in this story, because you take us somewhere else, and also just the progress of the cartel in Mexico?
So the cartels, one thing I really learned from working with Luis is that there are all sorts of cartels down there. Like, I thought there were 6, and that was quite a few. And he said no, because they have all these splinter cartels coming off them. And so they call them cartelitos, but there are, probably 10 times more than what I thought there were. And so you can have a really good connection down there, and you don't really know how high up your connection is in the bigger world. And then these cartels are fighting with each other, and so you can't just quietly, fold your cards and say, I quit, because you've got all these enemies who want to kill you. And so unless you stay strong, they're going to kill you. So there's a lot of motivation to do well down there. It's not like here where you can make a couple million, buy a farm and put your feet up. It's like there, things go longer. I know of one guy who retired from being a bad guy and just bought a nice place and just relaxes. I know another guy who's inheriting a house from his dead aunt, and so he's going to quit being a criminal and go live in the sticks, but in a free house. And so up down there, you can't do it. There's too many enemies, and people assume you're going to be coming after them. So it's just a different world.
You had mentioned testing and why the testing is important to this story as well. The lack of knowledge and the inexperienced person, but there is a big deal with the cartel, this testing, isn't it?
Oh, it's huge. And if I'm thinking I'm buying 95% pure cocaine and you're selling me 75% pure cocaine, if I'm stupid enough to buy that off you, then you're going to make a fair bit of extra money off me. And so you really have to know what you're buying. And if I go to buy a Cadillac and you sell me some beat-up Honda Civic, you've made a good deal. And so there they can really test. The guys who the Canadians were sending down just didn't know how to test. If I'm in on a drug deal with 3 other people and we have to split it up at the end, then I want to make sure that my packages are as good as their packages. And so it really does matter. And they vacuum seal the stuff so that you can't get in and tamper. And so they'll vacuum seal it and put a little crust on it so that way you can know that someone along the way didn't cut in and dump in a bunch of baking soda. With the really smart ones, what they can do is liquefy the cocaine, dump fabrics in them, ship up the fabrics as some kind of a clothing deal, you know, you're selling jeans or something, and then just get the cocaine out of the clothing. But if you don't know what you're doing, you're going to get ripped off in that, because you have to know how to test and make sure they're taking it all out. Like, it becomes you need your chemist to be as smart as their chemist. And dumb guys don't get given a pass. Like, it's not like a nice league where they play by gentlemen's rules.
Mm-hmm. What about the Gisby assassination, and what's the Wolfpack reaction?
It's public place down there, so they got him in a Starbucks, which so you have a Canadian down there, and everything would be nice and pleasant, and the prices would be low, and lots of sun if you like that. And, you know, the only problem is you're probably going to get shot if you're in that trade and you don't have your eyes open. And so the what that sent was a message that you can't really escape down there, and that tough in Canada doesn't really translate to tough down there. You know, that it's a different league, and the it does get you out of the habit of having a coffee at the same place at the same time every day too. I mean, if he had held back on those flat whites, he might still be alive.
What happens next with Nero, Dronjack?
So they're working on big drug deals, and they're extremely ambitious. Like, they're looking at how do we get them overseas. They wanted Britain. They wanted Germany. They knew pilots. They had hands in shipping. I mean, their connections really were pretty impressive. What brought them down in the end was the in my feeling, and not all of them, but a lot of them, was their being implicated in the Raposo murder. And so that took a lot of the big ones off the streets. The murder we talked about before, the guy shot in the ice cream shop, that was kind of too big of a case. And then it was just Nero made it too easy to solve. I mean, they get into this encrypted email trail. And I mean, I was almost slobbering when I saw the exhibits, you know, that all these texts back and forth where they did everything but sign their name to the murder. And you know, then cheering someone on, and so that sort of derailed things. They had if it wasn't for the forgetting the password and the sticky note, you know, that one sticky note cost them quite a bit.
And you provide all this incriminating evidence via their text messaging. It's incredible. All the spelling mistakes included, and all the bravado and machismo that's included with this, and some ridiculous stuff as well. What happens that you talk about, and for our American audience and international audience, but American audience, you talk about the sentences once they were sentenced to murder, the kinds of sentences that they received in Canada, despite these murder convictions.
So the big five got life, but a lot of other ones, I mean, the weird thing is that some of the big cartel guys who are in the book are already out. Like, there's one of them that is a big deal that they caught him. He was a huge, big deal in the cartel in the greater Toronto area. And I got an email last week saying, look what he's doing in Spain. And it looks pretty, it doesn't look like he's devoted his life to good deeds now. I mean, he's doing the same stuff in a different place, it looks like. It's one thing the cartel would be work with a lot of people who don't have a record, and so they're not going to get big time when they do get caught, and they're not really on the police radar. And so they worked with one retiree who had worked in charity work all of his life before he decided to augment his pension with drug money, and then another guy who couldn't quite get his career going, and so he was kind of the sidekick to the retired charity worker. They'd work another guy who had a shipping company where he'd send, you know, if you bring something back to a big department store or a big retail outlet, they'll resell that somewhere else in the world. He ran a company that sold these rejected items. These guys didn't get get all that much time and they get out on parole. And so the odd thing was, you know, when the book was hitting the stand, some of these guys were hitting the streets. Like they were, I mean, they could buy the first copies if they wanted.
Wow. Yeah, it is incredible. And it is incredible, too, because this is quite unique, is that you had access to those hearings where they were up for day parole. And again, you explained, well, I'll get you to explain day parole for our American listeners.
Yeah, day parole basically means that you can, you know, have a nice happy day and then you just get tucked in at night, you know, where you go back to where you were, but you put in the full day wherever you're, more or less wherever you want to, and you make a promise not to hang around with criminals, which is, you know, nice, but if you were knee deep in, you know, drug trafficking, there's a chance you might not live up to your promise, and then you probably don't have a whole bunch of other skills. So the parole stuff, the one guy we talked about, Eddie Mello, he was murdered by someone who was on day parole, who drove down, shot Mello and his friend to death, drove back to the halfway house where he was supposed to be staying and was tucked in at night, and didn't violate his day parole when he did two murders. And so it wasn't until a long time later that he was actually caught. So a lot of people have objections to day parole, and you should be able to start getting parole about a sixth of your way into your sentence, and it's pretty hard to serve a full sentence.
Yeah, it's the reality of the sentencing, especially when it's announced in the headline, we have parole eligibility in the second-degree murders, which would be first-degree typically in America. Second degree with the parole eligibility starting at 10 years, and you see some of these sentences where the parole eligibility could be 25, but it's set at 13, despite their history and their background and these crimes.
Well, and the guy who killed Mello got $50,000. He killed Mello's friend just because he was sitting with him. He was on day parole. He didn't know Mello. He had no interactions with him. And he got second-degree murder. Like, it wasn't considered a planned murder. He just made a plea bargain. And he also didn't say who hired him for the murder. And so sometimes the system can go a little on the light side. I mean, this guy, so he made his $50,000, killed an extra person. You know, he threw in an extra one. And then it wasn't even considered a first degree or a planned murder. It was considered a spontaneous one, which was just part of cutting a deal.
Yeah. Incredible. And, you know, we haven't, for our audience, we haven't gotten into this another bunch of chapters where you introduced Raul Bulhosen Rios and Docker and the UN group, as we had mentioned, but also Jason McBride, Michael Jones, and Jaghar Cuncun, who pled guilty to the assassination of Francis Bacon 7 years before, a notorious gangster from the West Coast. The entire story, though, in this, is this new millennials and the way they have done things differently and the way their behavior has changed the way criminal drug trafficking and murder and organized crime works in Canada. Tell us about what you basically demonstrate and illustrate in this book about this unique wolf pack.
That the old pyramids are gone, like it used to be in the olden days, that a boss could determine someone's career rise, you know, who gets what job, who makes money out of what. Now, if you can connect with someone with a cartel, including a minor cartel, you can quickly make a lot of money. And now it's not a neighborhood thing. It's not an ethnic thing. It's a internet-based thing. Now a lot of things that millennials are criticized for in the outside world of, you know, they always need to be patted on the back and, you know, get a participation points ribbon. In the crime world, it's sort of the same way. I mean, these guys get really cranky. If they don't get what they want quickly, they want to move up quickly. They're upset that their Ferrari isn't as good as their friend's Ferrari. So a lot of the things that you see in general society, it shouldn't be a surprise, I guess, that we see it in criminal society. And the internet One thing Luis, the Mexican journalist I worked with on this, pointed out was that it's the central thing now. Like there's one theorist who said we choose our tools and our tools mold us. You know, like there's the idea that if you're living off your phone, then you're dehumanizing a lot of people you're texting about. You're making quick impulsive decisions. You're being flashy just so that you're noticed. A lot of the cranky behavior we see on Twitter, we're seeing in the crime world from people who live off this stuff.
And finally, when you look at this and you provide the statistics, and they're not heartening at all, they're disheartening. Despite the fight in by Calderon in Mexico to fight organized crime, that was in 2006, and murder in Vancouver and places like Surrey, BC, inland British Columbia, what are the trends regarding murder in both areas?
That down there, I mean, it's just too hard to when you look at crime stats, murder rates go up before elections. I mean, if they don't like your political platform, you good chance you'll get shot, and they'll, you know, hopefully someone, you know, more amenable will come in. So some of the statistical stuff is staggering. The with police, you can't fire corrupt cops because they'll just get hired by the cartels. I mean, you can fire them if you want, but you're just wow, giving the cartel a good worker. So they're,
yeah,
the what it left me thinking was, is that the market? I mean, I think we should look at it on the other end and treat people with drug problems, better treatment, try and dry up the market on this end, also try and dry up corruption. You can't have organized crime without corruption. Like I learned that a long time ago, you can't, you're just a bunch of bandits until you have corrupt people on your side. And when you have a lot of money, the corrupt people tend to pop up. So my feeling is fighting things like domestic abuse and drug abuse and corruption is the way to go, and to stop trying to nab these guys because there are too many of them and they're too good at it. I mean, it's like being blindfolded and, you know, swinging a bat. You're not going to do anything. You're not going to do all that much. You're just going to shuffle the deck. And if you catch criminal A, that just means criminal B is going to make a little more money.
Yeah, certainly. The war on drug has been an absolute failure, and this clearly demonstrates that. I want to thank you so much, Peter Edwards, for coming on and talking about your latest, The Wolf Pack, the millennial mobsters who brought chaos and the cartels to the Canadian underworld. Thank you so much for this interview,
thanks,
Peter Edwards. You have a great
really
evening.
Enjoyed it. You too.
Thank you.
Bye.
Good night.